This is Fresh Air. We're going to hear the second part of our interview with Samin Nosrat, whose cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, is the basis of her new Netflix series of the same name. That title refers to what she says are the four basic elements of cooking. Each episode of the show is dedicated to one of those elements. Nosrat learned how to cook at Alice Waters' famous farm-to-table restaurant, Chez Panisse, in Berkeley, California, where Nosrat lives. She grew up in San Diego, where her parents emigrated from Iran in the 1970s. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. In part one of the interview, they discussed salt, fat, and acid. In this part, they'll talk about the fourth element, heat, and Nosrat's life. They started with a clip from the episode about heat.
Heat. It's the element of transformation. Heat takes food from raw to cooked, flabby to firm, pale to golden brown. Sizzles, splatters, crackles, steam, and aromas are all the results of applying heat to food. And once you understand how heat works, you can be confident that whatever you cook will taste great.
And that last sound is the sound of toast coming out of a toaster. That's from episode 4 of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is the Netflix show by our guest Samin Nosrat. Okay, heat. Heat, you say, determines texture. And you made a light bulb go off in my head when you said something. And maybe this is really simple, but that you want to heat something so the outside of the food is cooked or done at the same time as the inside of the food. And then that's kind of complicated.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, a big, big light bulb was understanding that the source of heat is not what matters. You know, I learned because I was learning to cook in a restaurant and I never really had a home cooking background. Mm-hmm. I learned to make braises and stews for 60 people or 100 people at a time. Hmm. And we always did that in the oven. And then one day I went over to a friend's house and she was making a stew on the stovetop. And I was like, wait a minute, you can do that on the stovetop? And she was like, I'm only making 4 chicken legs. And so I realized, oh, all it is that she's doing the same thing. She's bringing it to a boil and turning it down to a simmer and cooking it until it's tender. And we just use the oven because we have to do so much more. So we're using the heat in the same way. And it doesn't matter so much what that source of heat is.
Along those lines, you say that cooking in the oven is actually kind of more complicated than we think it is.
Yeah, I think we sort of associate it as this very straightforward and simple thing. Like you set the dial, you put something in there, and then, you know, you come back 18 minutes later and it's done. But in my experience, like no two ovens are the same. Even my oven, you know, on different days acts differently. And depending on what the weather is outside, what the weather is inside, if your thermostat is old or new, if it's accurate or not, how many times you've opened the oven door, a million different things will affect that temperature. And so very rarely is that actual temperature in there the very specific thing to which you've set the dial. In fact, a lot of those thermostats have sort of like a plus or minus mm-hmm. of up to 20 degrees.
That's a lot.
And so it's crazy. You might set it to 350 and it could be anywhere between 330 and 370. Mm. So, you know, we have this false sense of precision when we cook in the oven, but it's actually in some ways the least precise form of cooking because I think it also gives you this false sense of, oh, well, I don't need to like pay attention. So you sort of turn down your senses and you're paying less attention. And that is often where things go wrong. So I watch my oven things like a hawk. I do set timers, but mostly to remind me to move things around because the back will always be hotter than the front. Mm-hmm. And in my oven, the left side is hotter. But if I'm cooking at someone else's house, maybe the right side is hotter. So I rotate things. I move them up and down, up different racks. And I'm just always paying attention so that I can know when the thing is done.
Yeah, there was a good tip in the show where you talk about roasting a chicken. You put the legs, the parts of the dark meat, at the back of the oven so it gets more heat when it's cooking.
Yeah, and that would probably be a good thing to do with the turkey too, honestly. Mm. Anything that you have to cook where it's got multiple different parts that have different cooking qualities. I always think about putting the thing that needs the higher heat, the longer cooking time toward the back. And I actually learned that from an old episode of a Jacques Pepin cooking show. So it was an honor to get to sort of present it to a whole new audience.
Well, one of the things I like about the fact that your book is illustrated, and apart from the fact that the illustrations are just beautiful, is that there's no photographs in the book. And I feel like a lot of times when you have a cookbook and there's photos, people are always disappointed, like, oh, what I made doesn't look anything like the photograph. And so there's like this perfectionism built into that kind of style of cookbook.
What I make doesn't even look like the photograph. I mean, usually, especially anytime I've worked on a shoot, there are multiple stylists there and there's lighting. And, you know, I'm not a food stylist. I don't make food for photos. I make food for people. And I felt very much that I didn't want to tell people, I didn't want to sell them something that I knew that they wouldn't ever be able to get themselves, right? And so it's that same thing. And I'm that perfectionist too. And so I always have to fight against those tendencies in myself. And I knew that my message in this book was one of trying to get you a little bit looser and less dependent on measurements and like perfection, and to understand the thinking behind a recipe so that if something calls for chard but you only have spinach, you can use that. Or if it calls for chicken breast, but you only have pork loin, you understand that those are both tender, quick cooking cuts of meat, and you can substitute them for one another. And so if I gave you a picture of what my version looked like on a particular day, it would be kind of disingenuous, you know, wouldn't match up to my message, because yours probably won't look like that if you're actually doing what I hope you do, which is make the decisions that help you in the moment make the best possible meal for your own self and your loved ones.
Let's talk about the show a little bit. One of the things I really love about the show is the experts that you have, the people that you've chosen to present various food cultures. You know, there's a lot of grandmas on your show. There's a lot of rural people. There's a lot of people of color. They're not really the typical experts you see on cooking shows.
You know, when I started cooking, I was told repeatedly that I wouldn't know anything about cooking until I'd been doing it for 10 years. And after I was doing it for 10 years, that it would like be in my body, you know. And then later Malcolm Gladwell wrote his 10,000 hours, which is the same thing, right? Do it till you master it. And by that kind of thinking, if practice leads to mastery, then I've always thought, well, then who are the most masterful cooks?
You got to talk to the grandmas, yeah.
Yeah. And who are the people who've been doing it the longest and often with the least resources? You know, even at my house where I grew up, like I would go home early in my cooking career and just be like horrified, really realizing that my mom like used the dullest knives of all time. You know, and she, Persian cooking, which she's so good at, involves a lot of chopping, a lot. And if she just had sharper knives, it would be a lot easier and faster. But she would never let me sharpen her knife. She's like, no, no, I like them this way. And I've found that...
We'll talk about your mom later.
Yeah. The amazing thing is that, like, you know, it's easy in the bubble of a professional kitchen to get really sort of, like, finicky about your tools and your resources. And then you go out into the world and you see people making so much out of so little. And for me, I think I have always been inspired by like the peasant cooking and the grandma cooking, because in general, like the story behind that kind of cooking is it's people who had to feed a lot of people without a lot.
I think that the show itself is kind of a warming experience watching it. And I do think a lot of it is because of you. You're this very joyful person. It looks like you're having a lot of fun while you were filming it. You're very exuberant. You have a very expressive face that look, you know, you wear your emotions on your face. But
I had a joke that I was like I mean, it's not a joke. It's the truth that I'm the worst actress.
Well, that's what
world.
I was going to ask you. Yeah. Because I read that you're a terrible actor because of it, because
so
you can't fake it.
I couldn't fake it. And, you know, it became a problem.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to talk over you.
No, no. So how did that come into play in making the show? Like,
well, we all learned a lot about each other as we went along, you know, and I think we all realized very quickly that while I'm really good in certain ways, like I can do a million takes of any cooking thing. I can tell any story 1 million times with the same amount of joy. but I cannot pretend to be surprised.
Yeah.
When I meet someone this 15th time.
Yeah, so I heard that they wouldn't show you who you're meeting. Like, they would hide the people from you so they get the first take.
They started sequestering me. Like, I would have to hide in the van with, like, a coat over my face. Or, like, one time we drove in Mexico, we drove around the block, like, 9 times. I was the butt of a lot of jokes, which I'm totally comfortable being.
When you were talking about making the show with your director, Caroline Sue, it sounds like you talked about wanting to present feminism in the kitchen. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because, you know, the kitchen has historically been a place that feminists felt trapped in.
Yes, absolutely. Like, historically, especially in the States, a big part of, let's say, women's liberation and feminism and that first wave of feminism was about getting women out of the kitchen because, like, household chores were not equitable. And it became this, like, very important symbol for feminism to get that to be not the main duty of only women. But to me, you know, I believe one definition of feminism is, like, equal rights for all, treating all people equally. Mm-hmm. And that means sharing all household duties equally. So I think as far as cooking goes and teaching people to cook, I hope to teach all people to cook. It has nothing to do with gender, you know? And perhaps by inspiring more people, I can inspire more men to take interest in it and bring them into the kitchen. But in terms of the power of a platform and the power of media, listen, like, there are so many other shows where you can see all of these fancy restaurant chefs, most of whom are men, most of whom are white men, you know, and they're getting featured. But this show is about home cooking. And home cooking, often home cooks don't get credit for their work, don't get paid for their labor. And more often than not, for the last 10,000 years, they've been women. So 200 years ago about is when restaurants started. And when restaurants started, men entered the kitchen. And there was pay involved and glory and awards and titles. And then the professional kitchen became the men's place. And that's been reflected in media. And this was an opportunity for me to elevate and honor home cooks, most of whom are women and have been women for the great part of human history. And I don't think that that's always acknowledged by the media. So I think once we had that discussion, we were all on the same page.
You also have your own mom as an expert on the show, and you have her teach you to make the Persian rice dish tadik. And it seems like you have a little apprehension about that.
You know what my friend pointed out the other day?
What?
She said, you know, your mom's on the 4th episode, so by then we've seen you go all around the world with all these other people, and you're so joyful, and you're so over the top and loving and open, and then your mom comes up, and just imperceptibly you tense up.
Yeah, you totally do. There's this, like, kind of friendly tension throughout that whole scene.
Yeah, at one point, accurate.
Yeah, you say, like, this might be the first time we've ever agreed about anything, and she says, let's keep it that way.
Totally. I mean, I knew that it would not be easy. It wouldn't be the easiest scene, but I just knew it would make amazing television. And in a way, I mean, I was so happy to get to include her in my work. You know, my parents are immigrants. Like, I think in a lot of ways, they don't really understand. My mom isn't on the internet a lot. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really get what Netflix is or what the power of that is. She doesn't really text. She knows I wrote a book. She knows it was popular. I don't think she gets what I do, you know? Mm-hmm. And so this was a way for her to get to be involved. And I felt really happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, your parents moved to San Diego right before the Iranian Revolution, and you were born there. And you said that you learned to be a chameleon as a way to adapt to situations like living in a pretty white town like San Diego or going to UC Berkeley. Is it exhausting to be a chameleon? Like, do you feel like you always have to be on?
Not necessarily on. Definitely sometimes exhausting. You know, another word for it's code switching. That's
right.
Like the more sort of like whatever. But yeah, it's definitely, it can get hard to remember who I am underneath all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I started going to therapy about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the first times anybody asked me, you know, how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And that I really, like, took that as a question that needed to be answered instead of like a polite, oh, I'm fine. You know, thank you so much for asking.
Right.
And still sometimes like my therapist will say like, what would bring you joy today? Or what's fun? And I'm like, what's fun? I don't know. I only know hard work, you know? And so I think for me in this, like, I would say last 10 years, I've been spending a lot of my time and thoughts and energy trying to figure out who I am when no one's looking, and how do I be that person when people are looking?
Well, Samin Nosrat, thank you so much for coming to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Samin Nosrat hosts the 4-part Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is also the title of her best-selling cookbook. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger. If you want to catch up on Fresh Air interviews you missed, like our interview with Bradley Cooper about his new film A Star Is Born, or with Mark Griffin about his new biography of Rock Hudson and his double life as a Hollywood heartthrob and a closeted gay man, check out our podcast. You'll find lots of Fresh Air interviews. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. I'm Terry Gross.